Hi, I'm Mark Chavez. I'm one of the hosts of Let's Make a comedy docuseries podcast about the creative process. Each season, my co-hosts, Ryan Beal, Maddie Kelly, and I take on an artistic challenge and you follow our journey. In Let's Make a Sci-Fi, we wrote a science fiction TV pilot. In Let's Make a Rom-Com, we wrote a romantic comedy film. And on our latest season, Let's Make a Horror, we produced a horror short film. And when we run into trouble, we interview Hollywood experts. People who have worked on big things like The Blair Witch Project, The Office, Star Wars, Mamma Mia, and more. All three seasons of Let's Make a are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
When Charlotte LeBon set out to direct her first feature film, she knew what she didn't want to do. She'd been on plenty of sets as an actor, both in Hollywood and in France, but this was different. She was going to be directing young actors telling a very different personal story set near the place where she grew up in Quebec. I'll talk to Charlotte about making the film and returning to her French-Canadian roots. Plus, flying through a glass window, falling down a flight of stairs. This is just another day at the office for Kimberly Shannon Murphy. She is one of Hollywood's most successful stunt women, and she's written a memoir that weaves stories of her career together with stories of her childhood and the abuse she suffered and had kept secret until now. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You are listening to Q. I love a good Canadian homecoming story. Charlotte LeBon was born and raised in Quebec, but when she was a teenager, she moved to France, first to work as a model, then as an actor in French film and TV. Then she made her way to Hollywood, where she shared the screen with folks like Helen Mirren and Christian Bale. But when it came to directing her own first feature film, there was no question Charlotte was going to make it in Quebec. The movie is called Falcon Lake. It's a ghostly teenage love story Charlotte chose to set on a lake in the Laurentians, which is Montreal's cottage country. Falcon Lake premiered last year at Cannes and played at Toronto International Film Festival. Charlotte has been picking up awards, and most recently she won the John Dunning Best First Feature Film Award at the Canadian Screen Awards. She joined me from Paris to talk about all of it. Bienvenue. Welcome, Charlotte.
Merci. Hello.
So listen, this is a beautiful film. It's really aesthetically beautiful to talk about.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And before we start talking about it, I wonder if we could enter the world of Falcon Lake by talking about a piece of art that you made. It's called Fantôme d'amour. I've got it here in front of me, but because this is the radio, could I ask you to describe this piece?
Of course. I mean, it's something that... that I did after I made the movie, actually. When the movie was coming out in France, I had this urge to really get it out, like, completely of my system, because it's a very personal movie. And I needed to just draw pictures of it and draw images of it, or images that was inspired by the movie. And this is one of them. And it's actually a frame, it's actually a still from the movie. And then I redid it with paint on a stone, and it's called lithography. Mm-hmm. And then I printed it, and now I can sell it. So if people want it, it's available on my website.
On her website, I love it. And just describe the actual painting itself for us, or the lithograph. Like, what do I see?
Well, you see a little ghost silhouette that is completely lost in the grandiosity of Canadian nature.
Yeah.
That's how I would describe it.
Beautifully described. Yeah, I see trees, I see a lake, and this ghost in the middle of it. I think it's fascinating that you went through the experience of making a film, which is massively involved, requires so much of you, and you're like, there's still more inside of me that I need to get out, so I need to paint as well. Like, can you say more about that?
I mean, I think it's just when you do... I wrote the movie as well, and I think it's just something that it was a very personal movie, and I put a lot of myself into it, and I couldn't do, I mean, I don't think I could work in any other way than that, but still it kind of lingered with me and like a ghost. And it was just, and when you release it and it's finally not yours anymore, because you have to share it with people and it becomes its own piece. I don't know. I had this need to just get it out completely out of me. It's just I mean, it's kind of cliche to say, but it's like when you show your first movie, it's kind of like giving birth.
Yeah.
Even though I never gave birth and have no children. But I feel this is like quite similar psychologically.
Yeah. So this is a personal film, you keep saying, but it's all actually based on a graphic novel that was originally set in France.
Yes.
What did you see in that graphic novel that you connected with personally?
This graphic novel was given to me, and somebody said to me, I think you could be inspired by it, and I think it could make a good first feature. And there was something about the ending that I won't reveal here that really struck me, and the graphic novel stayed with me for a while. And then I just decided to try to do it. And I didn't know why I wanted to tell that story, but I knew I just had to do it. And I had to do my first feature. And I started writing, and it was quite difficult because in the beginning, the script that I was writing was more loyal to the graphic novel, and we couldn't raise any funds. We couldn't raise money. And it's really from the moment where I closed the book and I promised myself to never open it again that I really founded the soul of the story, and I changed a lot of things. It's freely adapted now, and but I think it was just like the starting point.
What did you change?
I mean, there's no ghost story. There's no sense of melancholy, of strangeness, which is something that I really enjoy in cinema. I'm a huge fan of genre movies, and the graphic novel was not at all into that world. So I added that. It was obviously taking place in France, in the north of France, and it was really important for me to change it and to transpose it in Quebec, because this is where I grew up. The relation between the two protagonists is really different. There's a lot of love. I could go on for a long time.
Yeah, let's focus in maybe on what you just said about changing the location to the Laurentians, to where where you grew up. What is it about growing up in Quebec that you wanted to capture in this story? Why did you want to set it there?
Like I said earlier, originally the graphic novel is taking place in the north of France, on the sea. And there's something, and I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is to grow up around the sea. I feel the sea is something that is very solar and claquant in French. I don't know how to say this in English, but there's something like really like crispy and fresh and solar about the sea. And I wanted something that was a little bit more ambivalent, a little bit more mysterious. And I think we have those qualities in our landscapes here. The lake, I grew up around the lake, and there's something so beautiful, but yet a little bit strange and menacing about a lake, because you never really know what's underneath the water, and the water is dark, but still when the sun reflects into it, it creates like these little details and it looks like stars. So I think that was looking for this ambivalence in the landscapes. And I think we do have that, and I think they're magical.
It's poetic. It's poetic looking. What do you remember about swimming in the lake when you were young?
I mean, I still have this feeling today when I swim into lakes. I mean, I really like it. I like the way the water feels on our body, because it's also soft water. It's not salted water like the sea. So I feel like the density of the water is different. It feels like the water is hugging you. And the way your body feels in soft water too is different. But still, you never see the bottom. And there's always this little hint of like I don't know. I'm always like a little scared when I swim into lakes. And I think this is part of the experience, and I think I probably enjoy it.
Yeah, it's part of the experience. I always think of like the sea or the ocean feels like a fully realized thing. Like it's already a thing that you're entering to, but I always feel, maybe it's because of how I grew up as well, that the lake has a coming of age about it anyway. Like it has a teenageness about it. I don't know.
Because it's full of secrets.
Yeah.
And unknown. It's full of unknown things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess growing up and being a teenager is also about that. It's diving into the unknown.
Exactly. So the movie is about these two teenagers. We have Bastien, who's 13 going on 14, and Chloe, who is 16. And it is important that they're teenagers, because even if they'd met maybe a decade later in their lives, in their 20s, that age difference between them wouldn't have been a significant thing. But at the age that they are, this is huge. Can you talk a bit about that?
You're right. I mean, I really wanted two characters that if they would have been, I wanted the audience to feel that if they would have been the same age, they would have been together.
Mm.
It was really important for me to make this story, this, because it is a love story. I think my movie, the way I describe my movie, I always say it's a love and ghost story. But I wanted the story to be really, to feel really true. And I needed to understand why this girl, even though she's 3 years older, she's attracted to this young boy. And this young boy is obviously attracted to this older young woman. And but it was really important for me that everything feels really, really authentic. And that was the biggest challenge, I think, in the movie.
It does feel really authentic. It's a beautiful movie. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power, and you're listening to my conversation with the Quebec actor, artist, and filmmaker, Charlotte Lebon. Her new movie, called Falcon Lake, won the Canadian Screen Award for Best First Feature Film. Charlotte has acted in both French and Hollywood cinema, and I wanted to know whether her early days of working as an actor informed the way that she worked with the young leads on her own film as a director.
Yeah. I felt, I worked with a lot of different directors, and sometimes I felt that I was, they were giving me direction that I would not agree with, or that would not be interesting, or that would be too, I don't know, too simple or too, I think I needed more complex characters maybe.
Yeah.
And I felt like when I was trying to give that, they would not agree with it, and I think that made me suffer a lot as an actress. And I've also worked with wonderful directors who would listen to my proposition or propose things that I would never think about, and that helped me grow as an actor. I think I've learned from my frustrations and from the great people I've worked with.
Yeah, to coach these actors, they're really good in the film. They're very believable.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And they're very, very subtle and complex. And especially the young man who plays Bastien, we see him wrestle a lot with the idea of whether or not to go in the lake or how far to go into the lake. There's a scene where he is in the lake and Chloe is sort of getting him to go further and further out. And there's a shot that I love where you see Bastien's head sticking out, and it's like the head of a little boy. But his body is underwater.
Why?
And the way that you've shot it, because of the way that water works, like the water magnifies sort of his body, and his shoulders look really broad and manly, and you can like sort of see part of his chest, and it looks like a man on the bottom in the lake and then a little boy's head, and he comes out and then you see he's like the scrawny like little kid again. I just thought that was so poetic and cool. That had to be a deliberate choice, right? The creative choice.
Actually, that's the only shot that we did in the water, because it was really important for me to keep the mystery of the lake, and I didn't want to go into the aesthetic of shooting too many shots underwater that could look really beautiful, but I thought that for the movie they would not help in the story. And this is the only shot that we have underwater, is the one you just described.
Yeah, but it's a very like caught between two worlds. Like he's a boy and he's a man sort of at the same time figuring this out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I heard this cool story about the cottage that you ended up using in the film, that the producers really had to work to find a place to shoot this and put up flyers around the area. Tell me how that came about.
Yeah, we had to. It was funny because in the beginning, when I wrote the movie and I and my producer read it, they were like, "Oh, this is gonna be super easy. A cabin on a lake in Quebec. Like, this is gonna be a walk in the park." Mm-hmm. And we ended up visiting more than 100 houses because none of them were perfect enough. And
why? What was wrong with them? Like, what was not right?
Well, in the beginning, I really wanted the house to be on the water. And then at some point, after visiting, I don't know how many houses, because sometimes the house was perfect, but the lake wasn't, or the lake was perfect, but the house wasn't, or sometimes there was too many like neighbors around, or it wasn't wild enough, like the nature around it wasn't wild enough. And so we kept visiting houses and houses, and everybody was getting a little bit discouraged because it was taking a long time, and the shooting was approaching very, very fastly. And then, like you said, they just started to give flyers around the region where we wanted to shoot. And this woman called and she said that she just lost her husband and that she was living alone in this house and that she thought it was really pretty and could work. So we went and we visited, and she was absolutely right. It was absolutely magical. There was so much life into that house. She raised our kids and did school at home in it. And so you could feel like it was so dense with energies and what everything happened in those walls. So we just decided to pick it. And in the beginning, I thought it was too small, but then my DP and my set decorator was like, no, this is absolutely perfect. We have to take this. So I listened to them and they were right.
Ah, that's amazing. It's also kind of magical that it's like a ghostly love story that you're telling in your film. And here's a woman who's lost her husband and is giving you the house that they lived in together.
Yes. I love the stories too.
Do you remember hearing ghost stories when you were a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I really strongly believe in ghosts, but I don't want to sound like a cuckoo person.
Listen,
but I've been through weird stuff. I've never seen one, but I felt some weird things for sure, and I've felt some things that in the beginning I thought were just in my head, and then I got confirmed that those places where I felt weird were haunted places. So I definitely feel that there's something in the energy that stays, that lingers. But I've never seen one. Have you ever seen one?
No, I've never seen one. But I've mm-hmm. also experienced similar to what you're describing. And I actually, for me, I find it a comforting thought that there are other energies that we can't see that are part of what's going on, or that there's sometimes a poetry to when you're shown something that maybe you can't see with the physical eye, but that you can feel. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I love the fact that we can explain all of those things either. All the things that we can explain, I think, are just like, possibilities of poetry and magic.
That's right. Art is a bit like that too. Like there's the same quality of ghostliness where there's like something more than what is going on, something more than face value. Like when I look at one of your paintings, there's a feeling or there's a sense that's baked into it that maybe I couldn't describe with my eyes, but that I feel. And I think that the ghosts and art maybe have that in common.
Oh, because
I've never
how?
Thought about it before that way, but now that we're talking about it in this way, like it is like a feeling or a sense or something that is
that just
intangible.
That stays with you.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's ineffable. And that another person maybe looking at the same thing wouldn't feel in the same way.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I love that. I'm going to keep that.
Okay. So we were talking a moment ago about your own acting career. And I've heard you say that the character of Chloe in this film in Falcon Lake is a character that you might have liked to play when you were starting out as an actress.
Yes.
And you mentioned a moment ago like that you were one of the things that you struggled with was maybe not being complex enough direction, mm-hmm. being given complex enough direction or given enough complexity. Can you say a little bit more about that, about your own experience as an actor?
What was really important for me when I was writing Chloe is that when I was writing each line of text, I would ask myself the question, but even it was the same for my other character, for Bastien, but each time I was writing a line of dialogue, I was like, would I be able to say that? Would I be excited to say that as an actor? It was really important for me that everything would sound right,
yeah,
and just. And because I feel sometimes we use actor to just give information. And when you're an actor and you feel that you're just being used to give information to the audience, it's not really interesting because you're not playing a character anymore. You're just a tool in the story, I feel.
Right. What kind of roles were available to you when you were starting out in your acting career?
I felt it was like this. Usually it was this kind of pretty reasonable young women. And after some point, it's quite boring.
Wait, do you mean that they were pretty reasonable as in they were like fairly reasonable? Or do you mean like pretty as in physically pretty and reasonable?
They were, I mean, probably both.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was, to be really honest with you, I was bored a lot of times as an actor. And it was really important for me to not recreate that on my set with my actors. I wanted them to be excited about their characters and I wanted them to feel, yeah, authentic and to be able to. And also there was a lot of improvisation on certain scenes. And I thought that would, it was the first time I've never done it in as an actor on a set, but I was really excited to try it as a director with my actors. And then I realized that it just gave them so much strength and confidence because they would propose stuff that would come out of their brain and out of their experience. And most of the time it would work. And I think that just gave them, yeah, this sense of being useful and to not just feel as a tool. They didn't feel like a tool. They felt like they were part of the story. They helped, that they were helping me tell the story. And yes, I really love them both. They were amazing.
Imagine how cool that is to have one of your early experiences as a young actor be so collaborative and to have your director want you to feel like a useful part of the artistic process. So cool. That's the first part of my conversation with the filmmaker, actor, and artist Charlotte Lebon. More with Charlotte coming up. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power, and Q is back in a bit.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You need art to live. I mean, that sounds so cliche, but it really, if somebody had the power to just take that away from me, I don't think I could live.
You can hear the passion in Charlotte Lebon's voice there. She really means it. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. Charlotte is an artist through and through. She made her career in France and then in Hollywood, first as a model, then as an actor. She's also a visual artist. And now she's decided to set her first feature film as a director in Quebec, where she grew up. It's called Falcon Lake. Now, in this part of our conversation, I wanted to ask Charlotte about her very first acting role, which was pretty unusual. It was around 2010, and Charlotte became the latest in a long line of Ms. Météos on a huge daily TV show in France called Le Grand Journal. She played this goofy, comedic weather person, and as you're about to hear, she brought her French-Canadian identity to the very first minute. I asked Charlotte what it meant to her to start out her acting career just like this.
That was my school, actually. That was my acting school. And it was quite brutal, but it was really fun.
Yeah.
Because I was writing, me and one of my best friends, we were writing sketches every day. We had to do one sketch every day and it would be broadcast on live TV every night. So each week we had to write 5 sketches and I would perform them, and they were like 2-3 minute sketches.
Yeah.
And yes, it was my school. I did a lot of different characters. We did 200 sketches in a year. But then after 1 year, I was completely exhausted because like the pressure, the pressure of performing every night was too much. The pressure of performing every night was too much. And then I just had to, and then I started to do like castings for cinema. And then I just started to try that.
Yeah. Wait, before we move on to that, we found your first ever appearance on the show as Miss Matsuo. And I wanted to play a little bit of it, if that's okay.
Okay.
If you don't mind, before this clip, you had, you know, this is your first appearance on the show. You came out, you started introducing yourself in this very plush Parisian accent, and then kind of you show your hand. So have a listen to this.
Je veux bien qu'on essaie de gommer mon accent, hein, mais je suis québécoise, moi, Michel.
C'est pas grave.
mais oui, c'est grave. Tu penses vraiment là, que le peuple français là, veut d'une Miss Météo qui vient de Montréal?
Okay, so that was some of your very first appearance. Are you okay?
I sound nervous. I think that sketch was not very good, actually. But
no?
Whatever.
Well, it's funny though. You got people laughing. You start by saying, like, in this beautiful Parisian accent, you're like, you know, doing the weather, and then you kind of go, oh, I can't do this, and then start talking in a Quebecois accent and go on to talk about how people are only going to want to hear you talk about caribou and maple syrup, and it's quite funny. But you said you think you sound nervous. What made you want to introduce yourself to the audience in that way?
Oh man, I have no idea. It's been too long. It's been more than 12 years. I was coming out of modeling. I was tired of the fashion industry. I was quite disgusted by it, actually, and I wanted to do more, and I wanted to create and show what I had inside my brain, and this opportunity came up, and I was like, well, I've got absolutely nothing to lose, but I was French Canadian, and this show was historically, although the Miss Météo that were on this show were French people, French girls, and I just thought that my strength was to be Canadian, because it was the way I was. I don't know. I felt like it was maybe a little bit more unique this way. So I was like, I better just start with presenting this from the get go and just go with it. And yeah, I think that was it.
I guess that's why I'm bringing it up for two reasons. One is that your first acting job, you're really taking creative control of what you're doing. Like, you're writing the sketches. You're mm-hmm. being funny. You're being laughed. The audience is laughing, but it's on your terms as a creator. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's there's an empowerment to that. And then there's also sort of just the homecoming aspect, as we were talking about before with your current film with Falcon Lake, this idea of using your French Canadian-ness to make your art, which I think is cool.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You know what I mean?
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the justification. True. And then I'm also interested in the pressure of it. Like, if you have to do something daily and make people laugh, and you're really famous doing it, and they expect you to be funny night after night in France, what's that like?
It's really stressful, because sometimes you don't want to be funny. And sometimes you're not funny too. I mean, I made 200 sketches. I mean, probably half of them were shitty. I'm pretty sure they were. But that's okay. And it helped me with ego, because sometimes you're just destroyed after a bad sketch because it didn't work out. And then you get up and you do it again the next day, and then the next day it works, and then it goes like that. But that's probably why I couldn't do it for so long, because it was too much for my mental health. I think it was one day I felt really good, and the other day I felt like a piece of crap. So it's a daily TV show is a very, very difficult thing to do, and I admire people who does it for so long. But I'm really good at just to just let go of things and be excited about the next thing. That the second this was over, I was just excited about the future and cinema. And then after a while in cinema, I was like, okay, what's next? I'm ready to try something else. And then I did something else, and I was happy with it. And I don't know what will be the next thing, but I'm still excited.
That sounds like a good way to live your creative life.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it works for me.
I'd say. I want to come back around to art and to visual art. In particular, on your website, there are tabs on your website now for drawing and for painting and sculpture and your photography and your film. But then there's another art tab, and it's called My Grandmother. So tell me about that one.
I mean, my grandmother, her name is Françoise. She's 92 years old now. And she was the one who taught me oil painting, because I made studies in fine arts, but they didn't teach oil painting. And she was the one teaching me that. And she's the first artist that I know, actually. And she started painting pretty later on in her life, I think in her 30s. And she just had this amazing talent, and she kept doing it again and again and again. And she was living in the forest with my grandfather, and I think she was feeling really lonely, and it was a way to feel her loneliness was just painting. And you could really feel it in the images that she did over the years. And she did so many of them. She probably did hundreds of paintings. And I think she's a true pure artist that didn't have the chance to travel and to maybe study as much as she wanted. And I think she's an amazing artist. And I will always be a fierce defender of her work. And each time I've showed my work in Paris, I showed a painting of my grandmother.
Not only showed, but sold, I think.
Yeah, and I showed it three times, and the first two times they were sold, yeah.
What does it mean to you to be able to sort of give her art this second life and find an audience?
I mean, for me, it's just like completely normal, and she deserves it so much. It's just a normal thing, and I know it makes her happy, and to be able to touch money with her own work, you know, I think the first time she made money, she was 87 years old with her work. So it was really special. And I'm so happy that I have this opportunity to give that to her, but it's because she's talented too. If she did like very ugly paintings, they would not be bought.
That's right. It has nothing to do with the connection to you. It's their beautiful works. Maybe as we close out here, you described her as a true, pure artist just now. And I'm interested to know from you, from somebody who's done so many different creative things, including this latest film, but lots of visual art. What does it mean to be a true, pure artist?
You need art to live. I mean, that sounds so cliche, but it really, if somebody had the power to just take that away from me, I don't think I could live anymore. There's really something that is my way of just, it's my therapy. It's my way of taking out things of my brain and thinking out things of my body. And I mean, each time I've heard artists talking about what it is to be an artist, people were most of the time I hear, if you can't do it anymore, you die. And I think that's maybe it's depressing to hear, but this is how I feel about it.
It's true. I mean, you'd have to feel that deeply about it to do this, because it's not easy either, right? There has to be a deep and need as deep as that.
I think so.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been a joy to talk to you, too.
That film looks like a painting, too. It's really beautiful. It's called Falcon Lake. It is Charlotte Le Bon's feature film debut as a director. You can watch the film on demand now. And that was my conversation with Charlotte Le Bon.
I'm Aurora, and you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You ever wonder what it would be like to be on set during a big fight scene in one of those epic Hollywood movies? A scene like this one.
Let go of my boyfriend, you crazy bitch! Bring it.
Okay, what you're hearing is a little bit of the epic fight scene between Uma Thurman and Anna Faris in the 2006 movie My Super Ex-Girlfriend. They go flying off a roof into the windshield of a car, and they keep on fighting in midair. Well, you're also hearing the sound of Kimberly Shannon Murphy just doing her job. She is one of Hollywood's best-known stunt women. And on an average day, Kimberly might be falling to her death down multiple flights of stairs in American Horror Story or slamming through a plate glass window in I Am Legend. It's pretty safe to say that in her career as a stunt woman, Kimberly has gotten really, really good at navigating pain. But all the while, Kimberly has been hiding a secret pain of her own. And it's a way more personal trauma than anything she's ever portrayed on screen as a stunt woman. Now she's telling her story in a new memoir in the hopes of changing the narrative both for herself and for other survivors. The book is called Glimmer, a story of survival, hope, and healing. I read it in one night, and I could not believe that somebody was able to not only go through what Kimberly went through, but then also write about it in the way she has. I was really honored to talk to Kimberly Shannon Murphy about her book. Welcome to Q, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
I was trying to, I'm like, where have I heard that before? The audio.
Well, would you take us back to that day? Like, I walk me through walking onto that set of My Super Ex-Girlfriend for the first time.
For the first time we shot her getting hit by a car. That was the first stunt we actually shot for that. So that fight scene that you heard in the beginning, we shot, probably for 2 weeks. So we shot it on the streets of New York, and then we shot it in studio on green screen as well. So it took a few weeks to shoot that whole sequence.
Unbelievable. And as far as the gig in the first place, I mean, this was your first gig as a stunt woman. So can you just tell me a little bit about landing this job and then finding yourself actually going through with it and doubling Uma Thurman on set?
Yes. It definitely changed my life in a lot of ways. I was kind of a struggling, just sort of trying to keep my head above water performer in New York City. And, you know, auditioning and trying to book commercials and things like that. And then a lot of my friends were getting into stunt work that I performed with. And so they had recommended that I send my stuff to, you know, back then we were actually mailing things in the mail. We didn't have the internet. And I sent my information to the stunt coordinator of this movie. And he called me probably a week later. And then I was just in rehearsals. It was kind of like a whirlwind sort of thing.
You're in rehearsals, but then as far as like getting on set for your actual first day on the job, this was a wild part of the book to me. You're sort of like waiting in a coffee shop, like waiting to be called at some point to show up to set. And you get a phone call and it says like, show up on Monday and bring your stunt bag. And you don't have a stunt bag. Like what's even a stunt bag?
I didn't know what a stunt bag was. And so when they called me and told me, okay, you're going to be going through a table, I'm like, okay, you know, and then just called all my friends to figure out what I needed to bring to work and all that stuff. So yeah.
You're going to be going through a table. And then what was it like to go through your first table?
It was great. It was really, I really enjoyed it. It was actually fairly easy. You know, they score them, which is so they kind of cut the legs so that when you hit it, it's made to break. And I think there was a bunch of pocketbooks and like purses on the table. So it was, softer on the softer side. So yeah.
After that first moment on set, was there a moment or a feeling that made you say, this stunt work, this is what I want to do?
Yes, I definitely knew that that's what I wanted to continue doing. And I was really excited because that film, I knew I would be on for a year. So I learned so much. I kind of had a crash course. A lot of people that start in the business will get one job here for a day, one job here for a day. And I got really lucky to be able to be on a show where I learned kind of everything in that year's time. And then after that movie, Uma and I became close. And then she was asked for me, you know, all the time. And then I met Cameron shortly after that. And so it was just kind of never stopped after.
Cameron, this is Cameron Diaz, who yes. is a famous actor and also who wrote the really generous and beautiful foreword for your book that we're talking about. So yes. other than, you know, you said you were sort of trying to make your way in the dance world, other than seeing stunt work as a good, stable source of income for somebody who's trying to make it in the entertainment business, what was it that drew you to the physical part of doing this work?
Well, I was always, since I was a child, always physical. I was dancing and I was a gymnast and that was just always a part of my life. And so I feel like everything sort of segued into the next thing in my life. And to get into the stunt business was really exciting to me. And the more I learned about it, the more excited I became and the more I started loving it. So it became just one of those things that felt like the next transition, like the next thing I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah. It takes a certain kind of, I don't know what the word is. It takes a really certain quality to be able to put yourself into physical danger like you do. My producer, Jen, and I were talking about this before. We were both watching your demo reel and trailer reel, like sort of through our fingers, like just sort of peeking through our fingers because we're like watching you, you know, get thrown at stuff and get your head smashed into doors and whatnot. Doing this for a living, like, are you scared of hurt? Are you scared of, I guess you can't be scared of hurting yourself, but what are you thinking as you're entering physically dangerous situations like these?
Well, the thing is that they're so well rehearsed, especially the bigger stunts. I mean, it's not like you go in the day of shooting and you do the stunt and there has been no preparation or no kind of rehearsal. So we're always like way overprepared and way ready to kind of do it. So it's not like, you know, when you watch it, it feels really, you know, jarring and aggressive, but really it's very well rehearsed and thought about and taken care of, and all of the safety measures are put into place. So it's not just like, oh, we show up and you're jumping off a building. It's like, no, we've done weeks of rehearsals and we are prepared to do the stunt. So,
yeah, you write about the danger of it in the book in a really interesting way. The quote is, there are rules here and the dangers are mine to choose. Yes. Which I think is really sort of at the core of this book and about what you're writing about. And we can't talk about the memoir, of course, without talking about the childhood trauma that you endured and that you explore in this memoir. So I don't want to make this hard on you, so I will give the bare bones here if that's okay.
And you won't. You're totally fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
I've been through a lot of therapy. I'm good.
That's pretty clear through the book. I mean, it's remarkable. So I will say, for people who are listening and don't know the story yet, you suffered sexual abuse from your grandfather from a very young age. And you weren't the only person in your family that he abused. So it's not a clear memory that you had for your whole life. And things came out little by little. So what was it like to go back and search through those memories in order to write this book?
Well, I would say the last 3 years of writing the book have been the most healing for me in my journey, which I had my memories at 15 and spoke about them verbally to my mother at 15. And from then on was in therapy and working on kind of just trying to unpack everything that I was dealing with. And my mother was also dealing with hers as well, because she was abused by her father as well. So that was just difficult in general, because I was a child and I was trying to make sense of everything that had happened to me, which you really can't make sense of it. So I think the last 3 years for me have been the most healing, because being able to write this book and have to read your life back is very different than experiencing it, if it makes sense. And I had a ghostwriter, so it wasn't like I would write and then she would sort of, you know, make it really beautiful and pretty and make it make sense. But to read it, it becomes a lot more realistic in the sense of, this is my life and this is crazy. And then, you know, the audiobook was finished, and then to hear, I had one of my actresses read it. So to hear someone else speak your story was also very a different way. I feel like that really helped me heal in a lot of ways, or make me also realize how traumatized I was and how neglected I was as a child, which is, you know, a lot to unpack as an adult, especially when you have a child of your own.
I think also you talk about this in the book that you wrote it for survivors, but also you wrote it to break silence. And I wondered if we could to talk a bit about the role of silence in your family in allowing the abuse to happen, because it was multi-generational. It was your mom and your Aunt Pat as well.
Yeah, I think until you break the silence of intergenerational trauma, you're never going to heal and you're never going to move on and you're never going to be able to get through it. And I think I realized that the most when I wrote this book, because when I got my book deal, most of my family stopped talking to me. And I have other sisters that are not written about in the book because I knew they didn't want to be a part of it. And, you know, everyone's reaction was very telling of how deep our trauma went and how everyone still was hiding from it. And everyone still just felt like, oh, if we just don't talk about it, it's like it never happened, which I think we're learning more now, especially with all of the studies that have been done and all of the doctors that have, you know, written books on just what it does to your brain and what it does to your, you know, your just well-being and your health and all of those things, and how it kind of comes across into your adult life.
It's not my right to feel this way, but on your behalf, I feel angry at the people who didn't protect you as I'm reading this book. Do you feel that way? How do you get over that?
I have been able to process a lot of that anger. And Gabor Mate, you know, the famous doctor who endorsed my book, who's become a very good friend.
You pride yourself in not asking for help. You pride yourself in putting up with it. You seriously said hurt yourself. You had glass in your face, and I don't know if you'd broken any bones or not, but certainly you had really seriously injured yourself, and you just glory in not showing any vulnerability.
And he said, you know, Kimberly, your first trauma was not actually your sexual abuse. Your first trauma was that you were cut off from adult support. Because if you weren't cut off from adult support, the abuse would have never happened in the first place. And I had never looked at it like that. Because I, you know, with my mom, it's difficult because she is a victim, but she was also my mother. So there's like those two, you know, hard truths when it comes to my mom. And by stepping away from it, it gave me so much insight. And so that's why when I say I wrote this book for my 15-year-old self, because I feel like if I had a book like this when I was 15 and I was going through what I was going through, and I had this book in my hands and I had this woman's story of what I have written, I think it would have completely changed my life.
Hmm. Going forward, will you approach your stunt work differently or exactly the same?
I've been approaching it differently for quite some time, and I won't do it forever, and I don't work as much as I used to by choice.
You got a lot of really well-respected people commending how strong you are, including Drew Barrymore, including Cameron Diaz. How does that feel right now?
Extremely validating. And, you know, it's interesting when you've been through the type of abuse that I've been through, and then kind of gaslit by your family when you want to talk about it, to have these doctors validate you and validate your experience has been life-changing for me.
Well, I think that your book will be life-changing for people, and it's really a gift. And thank you so much for having the courage to do it. I know it came at a cost, as you've said, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kind of unforgettable experience reading that book and talking to her as well. That is Kimberly Shannon Murphy, an award-winning Hollywood stuntwoman. Her new memoir is called Glimmer, A Story of Survival, Hope, and Healing. It's out now. And that's it for the show today. Coming up tomorrow, Tom is back with you. He will talk to the really tremendous songwriter Andy Schaaf, whose true crime-inspired album is called Norm. They'll also talk about how quitting drinking changed Andy as a songwriter. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you next time.
I wish you'd call me on the telephone. I want to hear your voice. Reaching late into the night, I would live on the telephone if I was listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.